Chapter 4. The Sacred and the Secular. The state monopolization of violence gained momentum from the 16th century onwards. States declared war on each other, controlled the judicial institutions that meted out violence, decided what constituted a violation of the law, and forcefully constrained their people through the threat of violence or indeed through the actual physical punishment of lawbreakers to abide by those laws. It could be argued that in Europe at least, the emerging sovereign state of the late medieval and early modern period turned to capital punishment as a means of asserting its dominance and its legitimacy of its claim to the monopolization of violence. That is one way of looking at it, but it doesn't really explain the spectacular nature of the violence enacted and performed by the state. It is true that the worst punishments in Western Europe were reserved for those who had been found guilty of high treason, petty treason, heresy, and sedition. It was indeed through ritual symbolism and ceremony to convey a wider message, to display the natural authority of the state. According to the historian Randall McGowan, following Foucault, this is part stemmed from a lack of means of policing society, but also from a belief that deterrence by terror worked. The willingness of societies to inflict death on those who deviate from the rules and the apparent readiness of crowds to enjoy the spectacle of pain and humiliation when it was meted out to people they thought deserved it are common to all cultures from the ancient world to the modern era. This phenomenon is about the relationship between power and violence. To understand that relationship, I will explain three elements at play: the evolution of the criminal justice system, which varied enormously, changing attitudes towards public executions and torture, why they were less frequently used over time, why executions eventually became hidden from the public, and the role of the state in the use of public executions. There is an important question fundamental to understanding what is public in these punishments. Why did people go and watch what on the surface appears to be such a cruel spectacle? What drove Londoners to hangings, Parisians to someone being drawn and quartered? The method varied, but after being hanged, the victim, still alive, was cut open and the intestines removed and burned, the meaning of drawn. After decapitation, the body was then cut into four parts, or sometimes torn apart by four horses, the meaning of quartered. Chinese citizens to a beheading, or the act of Ling Chi, death by a thousand cuts, or Americans to someone being lynched. Underlying this question is one that is more complex. Do people across all cultures and across all times share a fundamental psychological makeup that allows us to enjoy the suffering of others? Each period will have its own historical specific reasons for the spectacle of violence, but this, it would seem, only tells part of the story. The fact that spectacular violence can be found throughout history, including, one might argue, in the cinema and video games of today, tells us something about human nature and the extent to which violence can be repulsive and yet entertaining and exciting at the same time. Torture. The spectacle of the public tormented body was part and parcel of social life in Europe, at least before the French Revolution. European legal codes were inspired by ancient Roman traditions, which relied on torture for evidence. In France, there were two kinds of torture: preparatory torture, which took place in judicial chambers and which was designed to extract confessions, and preliminary torture, which took place in public on the body of the convicted criminal, and which was designed to either extract confessions or simply punish the convicted body. Either way, there was a deep-seated belief in the interrelatedness of body, pain, and truth. This is supposed to have shifted in the 18th century, when attitudes towards pain, death, violence and suffering changed. At least that was the commonly held view until recently, largely influenced by Foucault's 1975 book, Discipline and Punishment. It's true that between 1750 and 1850, imprisonment replaced most other punishments, as Foucault states, but there is a debate about whether this was due to the Enlightenment or the earlier changes in the criminal justice system brought about by legal reforms. Both torture and rates of execution were already declining in Europe during the 17th century, a period during which the utility of corporal punishment began to be called into question, and states developed other more effective forms of social control. But to attribute that decline to the Enlightenment is mistaken. The last use of judicial torture in England, for example, occurred in 1640. An exception seems to have been France, where, although torture largely fell into neglect, it was still practiced on occasion until it was officially abolished by the monarchy in 1788. The French revolutionaries felt the need to abolish it again in 1791, not because it was considered an atrocity, but because it was inextricably linked with the social assumptions of absolutism. The formal abolition of torture did not mean that it vanished altogether. It continued to be used in Europe's colonies throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, but its use was very different. During the wars of the decolonization in the second half of the 20th century, thousands of freedom fighters were tortured by their imperial overlords in Vietnam and Kenya, for example. In Algeria, French forces tortured, killed, and disappeared thousands of people, a euphemism for killing political prisoners without telling relatives of their fate or the location of their bodies. Torture was a technique used in authoritarian regimes, Stalin's Russia, Hitler's Germany, Mao's China, Pol Pot's Cambodia, as an interrogation technique, as a means of humiliating and degrading prisoners, and as a means of intimidating the population. During the Cold War era, military regimes, Argentina, Chile, Uruguay and Brazil, were the most notorious in South America, kidnapped, detained and tortured people they considered to be political subversives, and then often made them disappear. In Argentina, children were tortured in front of their parents. In Brazil, the military used what was called a parrot perch, an iron bar from which a prisoner was hung upside down by his legs and arms while being beaten or given electric shocks. No one knows how many people were tortured by these Latin American military regimes, but the estimates vary from between 100,000 and 150,000 people. In Uruguay, the worst of the military regimes, it is believed that one in every 50 citizens was interrogated by torture. Our knowledge of torture in Africa is less complete, although it was systematically practiced in Idi Amin's Uganda and Robert Mugabe's Zimbabwe. In South Africa, under apartheid, the security forces tortured and even burned political prisoners over open fires. Sexualized torture, especially of men, is underreported. Of course, it doesn't really make a difference whether torture is legal or not. If the state deems it necessary, it will use it. Despite a 1987 United Nations Convention against Torture, which has been ratified by 130 countries, torture, or at least the cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment covered by the convention, is still practiced in 141 countries around the world, including by countries that champion democracy, such as the United States and Britain. Some have even tried to justify its use with the theory of just torture used by Western powers after 9/11, when it was touted as an acceptable and credible form of extracting confessions on the pretext of saving thousands of lives in a ticking time bomb situation. It was an imagined Hollywood-style scenario that never, as far as we know, occurred. The resurgence of state-directed torture in the so-called War on Terror is a reversion to what was once unacceptable. Western democratic states are now claiming the right to do what they want to their enemies. One wonders to what extent tortures have been influenced by what they were seeing on TV every day. Between 1995 and 1999, there were 12 scenes of fictional torture on primetime TV. Between 2002 and 2007, that number had increased to 897. Human rights advocacy groups in the United States claim that American interrogators in Iraq were taking their cues from television. In what has become an iconic photo of torture at Abu Ghraib and the invasion of Iraq, where a hooded man was forced to stand on a box, wires on his hands and around his neck. He was reportedly told he would be electrocuted if he fell off. The picture is one of many taken by the guards themselves, often smiling for the camera, torturers pleased with their own work. Torture invariably produces what is now recognized to be post-traumatic stress disorder in the victim, both for having survived the horrors of the atrocities committed on his or her body and for the shame at having spoken against family and friends. But it can also affect the perpetrator or the war criminal, or at least some of them, who must live with the memory and consequences of having committed those atrocities. One can admittedly question a diagnosis that falls on both the victim and the perpetrator. To what extent are German and Japanese perpetrators victims of their Nazi and imperial states under which they lived? To what extent are American perpetrators in South Vietnam victims of an American imperial policy? Capital punishment and the spectacle of violence. Public executions were probably more common than public torture. Hundreds of years before the Roman arena, public executions were conducted in town squares. In ancient Rome, criminals were executed at midday in the arena. One of the more common modes of execution was exposure to wild beasts. Alternatively, prisoners would be burned alive, forced to engage in gladiatorial combats, or simply butchered. After the fall of the Roman Empire, and up until about the 15th century, executions in Europe were rare and conspicuously unspectacular. For most of the medieval period, crimes against property were treated much more harshly than violent crimes against people, which were often negotiated and resolved by a monetary payment, usually involving both a fine to a legal authority and a payment to the victim or, in the event of murder, to the victim's family. Over the centuries, however, public executions became increasingly spectacular, reaching a peak in Western Europe during the 17th century, followed by a rapid decline. There is, then, a resurgence during the 18th century. In fact, more people were executed during the 18th and early 19th centuries than in previous centuries. Some of the punishments reserved for severe crimes, parricide or treason, were horrendous, such as being broken on or with the wheel. The executioner broke the prisoner's limbs, either with a wheel or on a wheel, the custom varied, and then set the body on a pole for public viewing. This custom was practiced in France until 1787 and in Germany into the 1840s. In Britain during the 18th century, the English Parliament increased the number of crimes punishable by death fivefold, from about 50 in 1688 to about 240 in 1820. In France, by contrast, only 6 offences incurred capital punishment. Of course, many Britons were able to avoid execution by having their sentences commuted to transportation, so that the number of public hangings between 1770 and 1830 declined to a relatively modest 7,000. That changed by the 1840s, when capital offences were essentially reduced to 4, by treason, murder, piracy, and the destruction of public arsenals and dockyards. In London, levels of execution appeared to have been connected to moral panics about crime. In the first few decades of the 19th century, executions were taking place more often than any time since the Stuarts. During the course of the 18th century and across most of Western Europe, people began to reflect on ways to exclude violence and force. Public executions were still accepted and were still watched, but sudden death, hanging by what was called the drop, or the guillotine, was preferred to the long drawn-out torment that accompanied hanging by slow strangulation or the act of drawing and quartering. The drop was introduced in London in 1783 as a more effective and more humane form of execution, although expense prevented its regular use in the rest of the country until the first half of the 19th century. Women accused of petty treason, the murder of a spouse, were burned at the stake, although they were commonly strangled beforehand. The last burning of a woman in England took place in 1789. The practice was abandoned the following year. The guillotine, introduced by the French revolutionaries in 1792 as a much more rational, efficient and humane form of killing, was meant to show just how enlightened the French revolutionaries were. Death was meant to be functional rather than spectacular. To paraphrase human geographer Marcus A. Duhl, violence was no longer made to speak. It was set to work. For most scholars, the late 18th and early 19th century, in Western Europe at least, appears to have been a turning point in attitudes towards pain and suffering, death and violence. There is general agreement that attitudes changed, but disagreement over the nature of the changes and the reasons why they occurred. The spectacular displays of violence, especially when public executions were involved, appeared to have reached a climax between 1400 and 1600. After that, there were still extraordinary displays of state violence and cruelty, but cases began to wane. Norbert Elias, in part influenced by Freud, argued that Western Europe underwent a civilizing process, which paralleled the monopolization of violence by the absolutists and national states, in which aggressive impulses were tamed or repressed. That's one way of looking at it, but the timing of and the reasons for the decline are almost impossible to discern. Scholars point to things like the advent of the Enlightenment, the rise of a public sphere, the changes taking place in Western economies, and the increasing centralization of the state and its control over people's lives. Reform, when it came from above. Fear of the mob, at a time of revolutionary upheaval, as well as concerns about the immorality of the crowd, the belief that the condemned were not displaying the accepted amount of contrition, the increasing distaste for the smell and sight of mutilated and decomposing bodies put on display after executions, the humiliation impulse, for want of a better term, emanating from Enlightenment thought, as well as changing views about the privacy of death, all contributed towards changes in attitudes and the law. Nevertheless, executions were very often major public events, paid for by the state, and attended by hundreds and, in larger cities, thousands of spectators. In London in the 18th century, up to 100,000 people might turn up to a hanging. It was the behaviour of the crowd along the processional route in London from Newgate Prison to Tyburn, near today's Marble Arch, the traditional site of public executions, that was particularly concerning. The civil authorities feared that they had lost control over the process. It was one of the reasons why, in 1783, public hangings were relocated in the front of Newgate Prison. Although the reasons why this occurred are contested, historian V.A.C. Gatterall argues that this had less to do with humanitarian reasons and more to do with the concerns of property developers. it was nevertheless hoped that by removing the processional aspect of the hanging and by containing the size of the crowd, public order would be restored. That was not to be. Crowds in tens of thousands would still regularly turn up out to watch hangings, right up to 1868, when public executions were finally banned, but not without a heated debate about the benefits of public hanging. Judicial killings decreased during the 19th and 20th centuries so that they eventually became scarce and had disappeared altogether in many parts of the world by the second half of the 20th century. Eventually, technology would have a role to play in the execution of a criminal, again with the aim of being more humane. In the United States, the Electrical Execution Act came into force in 1889, despite opposition from an emerging electricity industry. William Kemmler was convicted of murdering his common-law wife, Matilda Ziegler, and was the first person to be executed by electric chair in Auburn, New York, on the 6th of August, 1890. It did not go well. It took more than 2 minutes to kill the man, who, by all accounts, died in agony. The last public execution took place in England in 1867 and in France in 1939. In the United States, executions have taken place behind prison walls since 1936, but depending on the state laws, witnesses, such as relatives of the victim and relatives of the prisoner, can still watch an execution. At the time of writing, capital punishment is still practiced in 56 countries around the world, including China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Egypt. China has by far the highest number of executions each year. It's estimated that 657 people were executed in China in 2019, although Amnesty International believes the real number to be in the thousands. In Japan, the process of execution is surrounded in secrecy. The place of execution is unknown. The prisoner is only informed the morning of the execution, which is held in the middle of the night, and the family of the prisoner often only learns of the execution after the fact through the media. The decline in capital punishment in the Western world over the past two centuries is meant to parallel the rise of a humanitarian discourse. Today, most Western nations have abolished capital punishment, but over 60% of the world's population live in the countries where the death penalty is retained. In those countries, debates over the abolition of capital punishment, if they occur, often center on the sanctity of human life. Religion and violence. The Enlightenment and the French Revolution were in part about separating religion from the state. Enlightenment philosophers were convinced that peace could only come to the earth when monarchy and religion were abolished. Or, as the French philosopher Denis Diderot put it, man will never be free until the last king is strangled with the entrails of the last priest. The sentiment foreshadows the revolutionary violence that would later descend on France. But this division between the church and the state, between the spiritual and the secular, did not exist for most of human history. It would have been unthinkable for anyone who lived on this planet before the modern era to separate religion from politics or from everyday life. And there are still many parts of the world where religion and politics are inseparable. The extent to which religion may have caused or incited violence in the past is nevertheless a rich area for debate. Much depends on how you define religion and its influence. On the one hand, there are prominent atheist intellectuals like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, and Sam Harris, for whom the very nature of religion leads to violence. William Kavanagh and Karen Armstrong, on the other hand, argue against these claims. Armstrong argues that modern societies have made a scapegoat of faith, and that large-scale organized violence is not linked with religion. but with human nature and the state. In a 2004 historical audit undertaken by the BBC of all the major conflicts over the past 3,500 years, wars were ranked between 0 and 5 according to the extent to which they were religious, motivated by religion, or led by leaders who were religious. The Peloponnesian Wars, around 460 BCE, ranked 0, not religious, while the Crusades ranked 5, very religious. Al-Qaeda ranked 4, while the invasion of Iraq in 2004 ranked 3, largely because George W. Bush stated that God was on his side. Most wars over the last 3,500 years were ranked 0 or 1. In other words, the conclusion of the audit was that there were few wars that were truly religious in nature. The audit is one way of looking at the question, but it doesn't consider religious movements throughout history that have led to untold deaths, such as the pursuit of heretics and witches in Europe, or the Taiping Rebellion in China, which cost the lives of millions of people. The existence of violent cults is also missing. Think of the apocalyptic cult in Jonestown, Guyana, where 900 people committed suicide, and the siege in Waco, Texas, that killed 86 people. Nor does it consider the religious inflections in social and political upheavals, as well as in warfare, that have gone on through the ages. Finally, it does not tell us whether religion causes more violence or whether it is a pathway towards a more peaceful world or society. I would argue that religion is both. Religion has the potential to be tolerant and accepting, and to be utterly intolerant and unaccepting, verging on the genocidal. Everything depends on the historical and cultural context. Much of religious violence in the past was highly ritualized, from human sacrifice to ceremonial cannibalism to scalping in certain North American and Mesoamerican peoples. In these instances, violence was spiritual, but demonstrating a causal link between violence and religion is more problematic. In the modern West, religion is no longer as central to society as it was, but it is still a powerful force in many other parts of the world. One of the more pressing issues of our century is the outbreak of extremist violence and terrorism, often in the name of religion. It would appear, for example, that Sunni Shia's tensions in the Middle East that have led to thousands of deaths are religiously motivated, although the line between politics and religion is often blurred. When religion is a factor in violent extremism, always a debatable point, perhaps the best way of approaching the question is to look at it as part of a larger culture of violence among communities that believe they are under attack. Messianic Zionists, militant Christians, Indian Sikhs, Buddhists and Muslim fundamentalists can all commit acts of violence in the name of their religion. Moreover, religion can still play a role in violence and warfare in the modern era by offering an alternative reality that provides believers with an ideological framework that can be fed into violence. Religion is not necessarily the cause of violence, but it often offers a moral justification.